Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Well, I am a fortunate guy this morning as I'm surrounded by children's book royalty. Here on my right is Brian Selznick, and I'm going to give you the title of his blockbuster book so that you know exactly who he is, The Invention of Hugo Cabret. He has a new book just out, The Marvels, described as his most ambitious work yet. And Brian, welcome back for your third visit to Up to Date.
Very happy to be back.
And what percentage of the books you've sold would you say could be attributed to the fact you've been on Up to Date?
100%.
There you go. That's the correct answer. And my other guest here today is another legend, Daniel Handler.
The other guest.
The Hello. Other guest. Just the other guy, a.k.a. Lemony Snicket. He has a new book out also, Why Is This Night Different from All Other Nights? And this is Daniel's first visit, and I'm wondering how you managed to sell, get this, folks, 60 million books worldwide without ever coming on the show.
Well, it is embarrassing. The truth be told is that I've, as you know, was invited on the show many times, and Brian Selznick just would call me and beg me to take my slot. He would say, please,
yes,
please,
would.
I can't stand it anymore. And I would say, okay, just to get you off sleeping off my couch, to get you out of my apartment, I'll allow you to come on the show and sell a few books.
Thank you, Daniel.
And that's exactly what happened. I can confirm all of that.
Yeah.
So what's the secret here, Daniel? What do the two of you know about?
There are a lot of secrets here, I think.
But what do you know about writing a children's book that so many others do not?
Oh, gosh, I have no idea. I try to tell interesting story in an interesting way. I have no idea why many more people have been interested in my work than I ever thought possible. What about you? What's your secret?
Seriously, you don't know why?
I haven't the faintest idea. You know, I used to have an answer about why people were attracted to the Lemony Snicket books, and then one day I heard an interview with Bill O'Reilly, also a radio personality,
yeah,
and he basically had the same answer for his success. Now, obviously, that man is wrong. And so I had to conclude that I did not know what I was talking about, which is a conclusion I reach a lot.
Hmm.
Brian, what's your secret, Mr. Snellden?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know also. I feel like the story, people often ask me, you know, do you test your stories on kids? Do you,
I was going to ask.
You know, do you get what their opinions are? And the answer is, you know, like, I don't. Like, I write the stories that I really love to write. I write about things that really interest me, and I try to put that into the story. And ultimately, you know, I also can't say why it is that a book connects with a reader, but when it does, it's really thrilling.
Daniel, do you test your books with kids?
No, not really. I have a kid now, and so, you know, you can't help but eventually having a conversation with him.
Like, read this and watch their
face. In your
face
house
and
all the time.
Yeah.
But no, I don't, because, I mean, children, I think, are one of the last minorities about whom it is socially acceptable to talk about in broad general terms. You know, people say all the time, do you think a kid would like this? And you would never say that about any other grouping of people.
Mm-hmm.
So I think an opinion from a child is just that. It's an opinion from one child.
Yeah.
But it does make even more inexplicable the fact that Mr. Selznick and I have achieved any sort of audience whatsoever.
It's true.
Well, Daniel, you went against the stereotype in your books because the kids who are the focal point of your work are always unlucky. They have misadventures. Why does that work? Because people want to read happy stories, don't they?
No, I think it's hard to think of an interesting story without at least the threat of something terrible happening.
Mm.
In fact, in The Marvels, Brian Selznick's latest book, available in libraries and bookstores everywhere from Scholastic Press, there's quite a lot of melodrama in the first section, which is wordless pictures, as he does. He's, you know, not always so gifted at words, and so he's just concentrating on the
drawing. Draw. Yeah.
But there's a really high level of melodrama.
Yeah, and a lot of bad things happen.
A lot of unfortunate things. So aside from basically ripping off that concept from me, I think he's also tapping into something that a story has to have at least the threat of something dreadful happening while it's going on.
And maybe it's obvious, but it has to have that why, Daniel.
That why? Well,
yeah.
I try to use all the vowels.
Well, otherwise there's no story. I mean, if you have a kid who's happy and he's in a safe situation and everything that he wants, he gets, there's no story. Because a lot of my kids are either orphans or have parents who don't pay any attention to them and then they run away. And you look at the history of orphans, which I did rip off directly from Daniel Handler, of course.
Right, it's never happened in
No, there's never been any other children's books about orphans
before. You guys are still speaking to each other.
Yeah, before the series of unfortunate events. But having an orphan allows the child to make their own story happen. All the choices are theirs. All of the danger is theirs. And so I think that's why. Are there other books with orphans before Unfortunate Events?
There's little else. Yeah. I mean, Grimm fairy tales are basically children who have
Charles
been abandoned
Dickens.
In one way or another. Yeah, I mean, I think it's very easy to have young protagonists by getting the adults out of the way.
Yeah.
But I also think of it as if you take a walk around the block and you see a beautiful bluebird on a branch, and then you see a burning house and you run into it and you try to rescue the child, but there isn't enough time, and you come out and your leg is torn off by an alligator. When you get home, you're not going to say, oh, the craziest thing happened to me the day, there was this bluebird on this branch. You're not going to mention that.
It's not going to be the lead.
The story is going to be all the terrible things that happened.
Yeah. So you're empowering children by going the route you're going.
Yeah.
Do I have that right?
Yeah, and I think ultimately, you know, children are aware they're growing up, and there is going to be a point when they are going to be in situations where all of the choices are theirs, and all of the, all of the things that happen to them are because of the choice of what they're doing.
Yeah.
And I think reading about someone who has to have things that normally happen to adults happen to them does empower them and makes them see that, you know, there's something in the future that they might be able to handle.
So, Brian, in your latest book, The Marvels, as Daniel just said, you go something like 400 pages before the reader comes across the written word.
Yeah.
Lots of illustrations. Yeah. Again, this is so genre-busting.
He does them all himself, the illustrations.
Which I have been.
Yeah.
Why does it work? Why did you go that way?
Well, I think, you know, people sometimes ask me, like, are you an illustrator? Are you a writer? But this idea is really that I think about is I'm a bookmaker. And so ultimately it's about telling the story in the best possible way. And for the pictures that I've done, it's about how they help tell this particular story. The Invention of Hugo Cabret was about cinema, so the pictures are like a movie. Wonderstruck's about someone who's deaf, so the pictures are sort of like how a deaf person experiences their world visually. And the pictures in the Marvel sort of become this family history that becomes part of the second story. But you understand narratives differently whether you're looking at them or whether you're reading them, and it's using that difference to help tell the story itself.
But again, what's so interesting to me is these drawings are in pencil.
Mm.
These are black and white drawings. These are not flashy, modern era, lots of zis, bam, boom, color jumping off the page. And yet...
Yeah, maybe you'd like to think about making them exciting, Mr. Smith.
Could you bring a little excitement to your work?
Hold on, I'm going to just take a note
here.
Well, you know, I like drawing with pencil. I like black and white. I like the mystery of it and the simplicity of it. And I think if kids are, or anybody, I think if any reader is presented a story and a character that they find intriguing, they will follow it. And with the simplicity of the black and white line, because it's all built out of lines, all the cross-hatching that I do, it allows you to come into the story as well as finish the story yourself. So I think that's a big part of what we're doing.
You're leaving something to the imagination.
Yeah, you know, I think
intentionally.
I think
when you watch young people looking at Mr. Selznick's illustrations, they lean in closer.
Mm.
It's a magical thing to see. You know,
yeah,
it's as if they're trying to get the mist off it. They're trying to look past the texture into something more that is contained there. It's quite a magical thing to see. Mm. It's something you see with, I think, many of the best illustrators, is that there's that element of mystery there.
Wanting to get inside
that
world.
Yeah, you see it with Don Clausen, you see it with Lisa Brown, you see it with all of the best.
Well, Mrs. Daniel Handler.
Yeah.
Well, gentlemen, let's take a break here. When we come back, we'll talk about the success they've experienced and so unlike anybody else, and how that's affected them. What do they make of all this? We're visiting with Daniel Handler. He's a.k.a. Lemony Snicket. His latest book, Why Is This Night Different From All Other Night? And Brian Selznick is also with us. His new book, The Marvels. He's also the author of The Invention of Hugo Cabret. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. I'm visiting this morning with two terrific children's authors, Brian Selznick, the author of The Invention of Hugo Cabret, his latest book, The Marvels. Daniel Handler is also here, a.k.a. Lemony Snicket. His new book also just out, Why Is This Night Different From All Other Nights? You know, most of us, gentlemen, will never experience success. Anything anywhere close to what the two of you have enjoyed. Because besides the books that have sold in the tens of millions and the reprints and the sequels, there have been Martin Scorsese movies and all kinds of offers. Daniel, what's all that like? I mean, that's just incredible.
Very strange. I'm sure I share
Is it strange?
Mr. Selznick's philosophy of walking around this world in a constant state of amazement. Yes, I never thought anything would happen. The most of the books that I admire most are somewhat obscure. And I always thought that, you know, perhaps if I got lucky, I would luck into some situation in which my sole recourse would be writing. But I certainly never thought that I would be, you know, recognized in the street or have any kind of effect on what has been mainstream culture. It's quite bewildering.
Do you feel like you could be pinched any time and the whole thing could go away, or...?
I do feel that it could be the longest running practical joke in the history of the world. I don't know why people I love and trust would be so cruel to me, but I do feel it's quite strange. It's really weird.
It's affected you how?
It's affected me how?
Yes.
Well, I am just back from the Melbourne Writers Festival in Melbourne, Australia, and that's, you know, almost as far as one can get from my hometown of San Francisco. And to go there and to have people familiar with what I've done is quite odd. So, I would say that I remain in a state of being wonderstruck, to quote a title from Mr. Selznick. What about you? Are you constantly confused?
Well, I am. And
Are you really?
You sound constantly confused.
I feel
constantly confused. Feel better.
Well, yeah. You know, I made books for 15 years before the invention of Hugo Cabret came out. And I had a good career. Like, it was, you know, people read some of my books. But, you know, I made the invention of Hugo Cabret during a period where I was, or after a period where I thought maybe I wasn't going to make books anymore. I didn't know exactly what to do. And it was the only idea that I had. It's about French silent movies, which is not something that you think of as a real best-selling idea for books for kids. But it was the only story that I had. And I had never made a book quite like it. It sort of grew and changed during the course of the time I was making it. And so by the time I finished it, after 3 years of working on it, I knew that I had made the book I wanted to make, but I had no idea if anybody would read it.
And I'll say that it was one of the most satisfying literary successes for in the world of children's literature that I can remember, because all of us knew Mr. Selznick from his earlier work. He was someone, and we would see each other at kind of librarian conventions and other gatherings where children's authors are welcome, which is not very many gatherings, incidentally.
A couple bars and that's about it.
Mr. Selznick, when I always say, I'm working on this book, I'm working so hard, I can't decide if the illustrations are going to be over here, if the text is going to be over here, maybe there's going to be no illustrations, maybe there's going to be no text. I'm working on it, It's about French silent movies. It has this strange coincidence in the middle of
and
it.
And you're thinking, blah, blah, blah. Good luck, buddy.
And then finally he would pass out, and the rest of us would say, that poor man. Linda Sue Park and I would just hold each other and say, what is wrong with that dude? And then finally the book was done, and it's such a marvelous thing. And then to see it reach this such a tremendous audience, and then I understand it was made into some sort of film. I don't pay much attention to that.
I'm going to Google it later.
Yeah, first-time director Martin Scorsese decided to throw his hat into the ring.
Do you remember the moment, Brian, when you found out the book was going to work at least commercially, that it was going to be a hit? There must have been a moment when you thought, oh my goodness, this thing's taken off.
Oh yeah, very specific moment. It was when I was on tour. I had just gone out, maybe it was the first school I visited, and I walked into the room I was going to give my presentation, and one class had gotten there early, and no one had read the book yet. I mean, like, the book had just been published like 15 minutes earlier. It seemed like it was just out for a few days. And there was a kid in the front row holding my book to their chest like a treasure. And the teacher said that she had read the book to her class and that she had never seen a reaction from kids like she saw. And I looked at that one kid holding my book and I thought, this might be okay.
Wow. And then one day, as Daniel just alluded to
that
this.
Kid was Martin Scorsese. Yeah. That's what's so weird.
Worked out really well.
You're sitting in an office, and it's Martin Scorsese, and he's across from you, and it's just a one-on-one meeting, and he's making a film of your book.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I had always been a Martin Scorsese fan. Well, if someone had asked me, you know, what director do you think might be a good director for this story. I never would have thought of him, but as soon as his name came up, I realized he's a film historian. He was a sickly kid who was sort of on his own a lot. He helped rediscover film legend Michael Powell in a way that echoes what happened with Hugo rediscovering Méliès. So sort of accidentally, I wrote this story that Scorsese had all of these relationships to. A review of the movie said it was Martin Scorsese's imaginary autobiography. And I thought to myself, I wrote that. I wrote that. And you know, after the premiere, I was able to say to him, you know, I think one of the reasons, when I look back, I think one of the reasons I wrote this book was so you could make this movie. Because as personal as the book was for me, it was clear that the movie was for him as well.
And he's a good guy.
He's a great guy. He's generous.
He's a good fella.
He's a good fella.
Yeah. Different kind of fella. Yeah.
And it was really astonishing.
And Daniel, I've just got to ask here, in terms of your situation, 60 million books sold. I almost can't get my arms around it. What was the moment for you when you began to think this Lemony Snicket thing just might be working, at least commercially?
Well, I think it actually was kind of a similar moment to Mr. Selznick's. I was on tour for the first or second time with a series of unfortunate events, and turnout, frankly, was not great. There were many bookstores in which there were hardly any people, and I just didn't know what was going to happen, and it kind of confirmed my suspicions when I had the idea that I was going to write a sequence of novels in which terrible things happened to children over and over again. I thought, well, this is going to be a failure. And so it was kind of gratifying in a way to be places
I
was a failure, because I thought, at least I was right about something. This proves that I can think ahead and make a plan. But I was at a bookstore and literally no one came.
Ouch.
And so I was signing the stock, which is something that the bookstore asks you to do out
of
pity.
Of course.
And there I was signing the stock, and then this girl raced in with her mom, and they'd driven a long way, and they were late, and they were worried that they were going to miss me. Hmm. And so I did this whole shtick for this one girl, and I had an accordion, and I was playing a song about Count Olaf. I did this whole presentation for her, and she was this very young girl with kind of haunted eyes, and she had all these questions about the book that were very, very specific about the entire series that had gone on so far. I think it was at the second volume or the third volume, and then we had a galley of the next volume, and we gave it to her, and I began to think, well, this is the kind of readership that I thought I would get. It would be very small, but it would be very devoted.
Passionate.
And you know, you kind of never love a book the way you love a book when you're 10, and it's a sacred space that part
yes.
of the kid's head.
Yes.
You're participating in the literature that you don't get to do when you're an adult. You're thinking about it, and you're kind of in it, and you're kind of rewriting it in your head.
Yeah.
And
everything.
I have
feels
a child
like a true
now,
story.
And I watch him doing that with his favorite books, that he just likes to kind of sit on his bed and think about them.
Mm-hmm.
And to know that I was doing that, that felt like a success.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't, unfortunately, a success that you could take to your landlord right away, but it was.
It got there.
But it was exactly what I was trying to do, and that was quite magical.
And to this day, you remember that little girl.
She came to see me again years and years later, and there was a huge crowd, and she stood in line, and she had a picture. And she'd had some kind of Polaroid-esque camera when she came to see me the first time. So I actually had a very similar picture that I had kept. And so she said, "You won't remember me." And as soon as she put the picture down, I remembered her at once. And then we had this conversation because she said, "You look a lot older." And I said, "You look way a lot older. You're in college. You're a person now. I just got grayer and fatter."
That's the voice of Daniel Handler, a.k.a. Lemony Snicket. His new book, Why Is This Night Different From All Other Nights? We're also visiting this morning with Brian Selznick. He's the author of The Invention of Hugo Cabret, his latest book, The Marvels. It's out now. It's time for a break. And welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. We're visiting with children's book royalty this morning, Brian Selznick, the author of the new book, The Marvels, described as his most ambitious work yet. You know him as the author of The Invention of Hugo Cabret. Also here, Daniel Handler, a.k.a. Lemony Snicket, his latest book, Why This Night is Different From All Other Nights. And I'm wondering, what brought you two together to Kansas City, Daniel? You were here on Saturday for an event at the Kansas City Public Library. It was co-sponsored by the Reading Reptile and the Rabbit Hole. Are you touring together? What are you doing? You're in a band together? What are you doing?
We're putting the old band back together. Yeah. Well, we're both big fans of the Reading Reptile. It is the sort of children's bookstore that helped put both of us on the map, mm-hmm. and their dedication and imagination and integrity are untouchable. And yes. basically, whenever they call me, I say, great, I'll be right out.
Yeah, and there's no place like it in the country. And now their new venture, The Rabbit Hole, which is going to be the first national children's book center museum. It's sort of like a mashup of the City Museum in St. Louis and what they've been doing at the Reading Reptile, where every few months the entire space is going to change and it's going to be like going into children's books. We're here to support The Rabbit Hole as well. And there was a big fundraiser, and it's going to be a place unlike anywhere else in the world.
Yeah,
I would agree.
You know, I'm wondering, Brian, is there pressure from success as monumental as you've had to find a way to reproduce it every time you put out a book? Are you worried that people are looking at your latest book thinking, is this all you got this time, buddy? or what's that like when you're in your position?
I think there's a sense that whatever I'm working on isn't going to ever come out well. Like, I'm always working under a feeling that this time it's not going to work. And the success of anything previous doesn't help that sensation. So it's almost like it doesn't matter what happens ultimately. The only thing that matters is the story itself. So there's no way, like, the only thing you can control is what's inside the book. You can control the story. I can control the pictures. I can control how the narrative unfolds. But once it's done, and it goes out into the world, I can't do anything about that.
So you can shut it off. You can shut off the outside world and just focus on what you're doing.
Yeah, and so it's when I'm inside a book, and luckily I did start Wonderstruck, the book I did after the invention of Hugo Cabret, before Hugo came out. So I was already underway with that. And then once Wonderstruck finished and I went on tour, I began to think about what The Marvels was going to be. And, you know, The Marvels I started working on probably about 4 years ago, and so it's a very hermetic feeling while you're inside a story, and nothing else matters. The success or failure of anything else previous doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is how the kid you're writing about is going to do what he needs to do, and how the things that are happening to him happen.
Are you a different person while you're working in the middle of a book as opposed to when it's done?
That's maybe a question.
We hope so.
It's maybe a question for my husband, because I think he probably thinks that I'm maybe a little meaner, a little more angry in the middle of something when everything feels raw and I'm frustrated
You're fighting through it, right?
Oh, yeah. It's a struggle. And I have an editor, Tracy Mack at Scholastic, who works very hard with me to help guide these books and shape these books. And we don't always see eye to eye. And mm-hmm. so it causes a lot of frustration. Then I feel bad about myself, because for most of the process, the drawings don't look the way I want them to look. The story hasn't found the right path quite yet. So it's frustrating. And my anger tends to go outward. And so it's hard. But like I said, by the time it's done, my husband's less angry at me, and I feel better about what I have done. It's like Dorothy Parker said, I don't like writing, I like having written.
Yes.
And I feel a lot. I mean, I love the process.
Oh,
but
yeah? That's interesting to me.
Well, you know, as a journalist for 35 years, I can relate just a little bit. Mm. When you're in the middle of a long story and you're struggling through it, trying to find its direction, its course, its rightful path, that's a really hard place for me to be.
Yeah.
I don't like being in that place.
Yeah, because you don't know how it's going to end.
Yes, of course.
And
not.
Once it's ended, you then know this. You know what's happened. And so for me, as time goes by, it becomes easier to think about a story, because the pain of having made it fades away. From what I hear, that got a parallel with childbirth.
Like okay.
I hear you forget about that pain. And so then
my wife is waiting for that, by the way.
That's why you only have one kid.
She keeps saying, I've heard that you forget all about the pain, and I remember every moment of it, and I'm waiting. Our son's 11, by the way, so it's been a while.
Well, Daniel, I'm afraid to ask you, are you a different guy when you're in the middle of a book as opposed to when it's finished?
It's interesting to me, because I think I feel the opposite of how Mr. Selznick feels. which is that I really love being immersed in it, and I'm really sad when it's over. Mm-hmm. I don't know what to do with myself. I actually was recently talking to another writer, and he said, oh, I've just finished writing a book, and this is the time that I hate. It's so lonely. I don't know what to do with my time all day. And I say, yeah, no, I have the exact same thing. Maybe you go to lunch with somebody, but you just can't know what to do with yourself. And he said, yeah, it's the hardest 18 months that I do. And I said, oh, I do it for like 3 days. And then I started on a new thing. I love being immersed in it. So I don't think I'm a different person, but also I'm married to an illustrator and a writer. And so she's at her studio all day long. And then sometimes we come back and meet up at the house for dinner, and we're both hopelessly spacey, and my son's exhausted from school, and we're like three zombies wandering around eating enchiladas.
Yeah.
It's not always enchiladas, but it's just an example of something that I prepare.
Well, time for a break here. When we come back, we're going to talk about the power of imagination. I'm visiting with Daniel Handler, a.k.a. Lemony Snicket, his latest book, Why Is This Night Different from All Other Nights? Brian Selznick is back here for his third visit to Up to Date, his latest book, The Marvels. And welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. I'm talking with a pair of terrific children's book authors. You've heard of them. Daniel Handler, Lemony Snicket, his latest book, Why Is This Night Different from All Other Nights? Brian Selznick, he wrote The Invention of Hugo Cabret, his latest book, The Marvels. Daniel, just give me a quick sense of Why Is This Night Different from All Other Nights? It tracks the young Snicket's adventures during his apprenticeship at the VFD, the Volunteer Fire Department. That's a mysterious organization that readers familiar with the Snicket stories will recognize. Tell us about it.
And for whom I pity them, if they're familiar with the Snicket stories. Why Is This Night Different from All Other Nights is the fourth and final volume mm-hmm. in the series All the Wrong Questions, which, as you say, chronicles Mr. Snicket's youth and apprenticeship. Each of the volumes in All the Wrong Questions has a crime. We've had theft, kidnapping, and arson. And here in this fourth volume, there's a murder that takes place on a train.
Mm.
Everyone's a suspect. Even Brian Selznick, although he's not actually in the book or on the train.
I didn't do it.
Yeah. He didn't do it. So Mr. Snicket is on a racing train trying to solve the crime before the train reaches its somewhat sinister destination.
Mm. Brian Selznick, tell us about The Marvels.
It's a story about a theater family. It begins in 1766 and follows five generations of the same family through 1900. There's a cliffhanger that's all done in pictures. And then you turn the page, and the next 200 pages is a separate story, all in text, about a boy named Joseph who runs away from boarding school to look for an uncle who he's never met. And eventually these two narratives come together through Joseph.
It's quite magical, I will say. Wow. I love this book very much.
Let's talk imagination for a moment, Daniel, because I want to read the plot line for one of your earlier books, which is
The Wide Window.
And this focuses on your three orphans. Let me just read this, and I want to get your reaction to it. This story begins when the orphans are being escorted by the well-meaning Mr. Poe to yet another distant relative who has agreed to take them in since their parents were killed in a horrible fire. Aunt Josephine, their new guardian, is their second cousin's sister-in-law, and she's afraid of everything. Her house, perched precariously on a cliff above Lake Lacrimose, is freezing because she's afraid of the radiator exploding. She eats cold cucumber soup because she's afraid of the stove, and she doesn't answer the telephone due to potential electrocution dangers. Her greatest joy in life is grammar, however, and when it comes to the proper use of the English language, she is fearless. Where do you come up with this stuff? Cucumber soup and electrocution and grammar and all this stuff.
Well, I think part of the structure of a series of unfortunate events is to play upon the common anxieties and fears of childhood and kind of have them writ large. And so having your grammar corrected is a huge part of growing up. People are always saying, you don't say it that way, you say it this way. And It's often when you're in the middle of something you're speaking very passionately about. You know, you'll be saying to your father, and then they went over, and he'll say, it's actually had and not has. And it's something that everyone remembers from their childhood. And so the character of Aunt Josephine is part of that voice. And things like cold cucumber soup, there's a lot of threatening food in a series of unfortunate events, because that's part of the adventure of childhood, is that there's only certain things you eat, and you start and you have that fear. You say, oh, we're all going over to Aunt Jane's house for lunch, and you're thinking, oh no, she's gonna fix that thing again that's inedible, and then I have to eat it because it's my Aunt Jane, and everybody's looking at me. That's part of it. It's not until you become an adult that you say, you know what, we're gonna go to a party, it's gonna be fine. Mm-hmm. I don't know what exactly is going to be served, but it's gonna be fine. But when you're a child, that's a piercing obsession. And so that many of the fears and anxieties in a series of unfortunate events take the everyday anxieties of growing up and write them larger.
You know, most adults, though, have forgotten about that stuff. How do you sort of channel yourself to sort of put yourself in the mindset of a kid?
Well, you know, I get asked this, and I'm sure Mr. Selzik does this in one time or another, and I'm not convinced that adults really forget about it. Mm-hmm. I think that we say over and over to ourselves and to others, well, that's your childhood. You put that aside and you don't think about it. But in my experience, if you open up a conversation like that at a dinner party, say, if you say, this is what I was afraid of as a child, everybody will go around the table and say what they were afraid of. When I was working on my first technically young adult novel, Why We Broke Up, someone would say, oh, what are you working on? And I would say, I'm working on this book about a high school couple that breaks up, and immediately everyone would have a story. It was amazing. You know, mm-hmm. No one would not say, oh, let me tell you what happened to me. I was dating Lorraine. And I think that those things that are important to us were always important to us. It's just that part of the journey of adulthood is that we say what we should be thinking about is what's here in this newspaper or these bills that are piling up here or this professional conflict. We say it's time to put those things away. You can't spend your whole life thinking about them. And Mr. Selzik and I are in the luxurious position of being able to think about our childhood fears and anxieties for the rest of our lives.
All the time.
How lucky we are.
Brian, are you constantly writing notes to yourself about ideas for an illustration or a storyline or a plot line? You're sticking them away in some folder somewhere? Or how do you roll with all that stuff?
You know, I used to feel really bad about this because I get one idea every 3 to 5 years. And I'm friends with a lot of people like Mr. Handler who have a lot of ideas and who are working on what seem like a lot of different projects. And I would be asked what I was working on and I would say, oh, it's the same book I was working on 3 years
ago. Just
the same
old thing.
You asked me that. But I eventually realized that my ideas take 3 to 5 years to make. And so I only need one idea every 3 to 5 years. And it starts with usually a single image, a single action, an anecdote that I've heard. And I do start by writing in longhand. But even before I begin writing, it mostly is just accumulating in my head while I'm living my life and doing whatever it is that I'm doing. And then once something solid begins to form around the idea, it starts being written down.
And Daniel, you stashing away ideas in a drawer?
I carry a notebook with me at all times.
Do you?
In which I write down. I mostly eavesdrop. Yeah. Things that I eavesdrop, I hear. I won't write down.
Could you read that, please, to us?
And what about this last 45 minutes you
did? It's unforgettable. I'll give you that. And then I write on legal pads, longhand, looking often like a crazy person if I'm in public. It's funny, with the rise of digital technology, I mean, it sounds like an old man already to say the rise of digital technology because it goes without saying that everyone's in the digital world. But when I am at a cafe with a legal pad, I think I look so much like a potential serial killer that everyone just steers clear of me. And then I type it into the computer, and then I print it out, and then I tear it up, and, you know, I go on and on. But you're not, Mr. Selzik's not much of a sketcher.
No.
Right? Yeah.
No.
My wife is she would be sketching right now. She would be drawing the curly curls of the microphone cords.
Yeah, I have a strange relationship to drawing. Like, I love drawing. I grew up drawing. I identify very much as someone who draws. But I tend to only draw for a specific project. Mm-hmm. And also the drawings that I do in the book, which are relatively realistic, take a long time to prepare for. I can't just sit down and draw something from my head. I can draw the idea of what I'm going to eventually have from my head. I can draw a little thumbnail sketch and it's very messy. And it has some energy. It has composition. It has direction. But in terms of the details, the faces, the landscape, the world inside the picture, that's months and months of research, traveling, photographing people and different things to prepare to do one of those drawings.
Well, gentlemen, you've just been great. We're out of time. Daniel Handler, a.k.a. Lemony Snicket, he has a new book out, Why Is This Night Different from All Other Nights? Brian Selznick, his latest book, The Marvels, just out for sale now. He's also the author of The Invention of Hugo Cabret. Thank you so much.
Really my pleasure. You thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much.
So great to have you.